Welcome to the Wildly Capable Podcast by NovoEd, hosted by Todd Moran and Alex Gruen. On Wildly Capable, we explore unusual sources of deep capabilities and unexpected insights on human capital. On this episode, Todd and I interview Ramzi Rabbani, Vice President of Product, Design, and Engineering at Experience Point. Ramzi, when something that's considered to be the best type of a particular product, they're often referred to as the Rolls Royce of that product. And when we say that you're the Rolls Royce of guests here on Wildly Capable, it takes on whole new meaning because beyond the fact that we're thrilled to host you, you actually started your career as a mechanical engineer at Rolls Royce. Ramzi, to kick things off, can you talk a little bit about your experience there and maybe some ways that it's had some bearing on your leadership capabilities later on?
Absolutely. So I started my career, you know, I've always been passionate about products and building products. And to me, products initially was synonymous with physical products that I could see and that I could, you know, touch. And so as a mechanical engineer, naturally engines were kind of the next translation of that. And so I jumped into Rolls-Royce, and we were working on gas turbine engines at the time. No, we did not get cars. We did not get courtesy cars. I get asked that question every single time. Did you get a courtesy car? They're actually two distinct businesses. We started as a mechanical engineer working on gas turbine engines, and quickly jumped into a leadership role within my second year. And we conceived a new engine called G0 at the time. It was a great opportunity to be able to see an entire product conceived from start to finish with a company that truly operated with the principle of trusted to deliver excellence. So Rolls-Royce taught me a few things. You're working with some of the brightest individuals out there, but all share one common passion, which is deliver amazing products to our clients. And from a leadership standpoint, it's quality that it taught me. It's scale. That quality can be achieved at scale. And ultimately that, products are fun to conceive, but it also taught me that, life cycle for me is important, life cycle of a product. And for gas turbine engines, that life cycle is extremely long. So definitely a great learning experience from the start. A good name on the resume to start.
Ramzi, I'd be intrigued when you talk about the life cycle component. I know this idea brings to mind to me immediately this idea of feedback loops and how do you create those both constantly from field to customer to back into back office engineering product teams. How important was that idea of the sort of the continuous feedback loop in your evolution and that which you experienced at Rolls-Royce? Talk to us a little bit about that.
Absolutely, Todd. I think for me, that was a big component of my departure and moving into digital products because the feedback loop was quasi non-existent. The feedback loop was very, at the onset, extremely heavy in the terms of requirements and then kind of breaking them down. And then it was, a lot of validation, but validation, internal validation, whether or not we were meeting those requirements. So there was very little room for that type of continuous feedback. And then the second one was also the joy of building a product where people relate to. So with gas turbine engines, if they work, people expect it. So there's really no delight there, no delight element. But if it doesn't work, then, you're on the hook and it's not very fun. So to me, that was a very big component of wanting to move away from physical products that I was building and moving into one with faster feedback cycles.
Brilliant. I mean, it's interesting, Ramzi, we talk a lot about, at NovoEd, sort of this idea of facilitating organizational agility. How can organizations shift, not necessarily on a moment's notice, but in short order, especially now with the ever-shortening half-life of skills and the need to sort of pivot, anticipate, entirely new disruptive pieces coming into organizations. We feel like a common thread in your career has been one of pivoting, the ability to constantly change, adapt, learn, continue. continuously. And I think even the very beginning, if I have this right, it was a scant two weeks of law school before you pivoted and then went engineering. And then following your time at Rolls-Royce, I think you yet pivoted again into this whole digital transformation in the financial services, in the FinServ space at Scotia Bank. Can you talk to us a little bit about that idea of pivoting and agility and maybe how important you think that is, not just for individuals, but for organizations in current state?
Absolutely. I think to me, when people ask me about learning, first and foremost, I say there's no such thing as linear learning. It's adaptive learning, first and foremost. So even the way I learn on the job and as needed for the job. I don't have a clear path of what I am going to learn for the next 3 years. And that's one thing with organizations where I struggle, where they give you like the career development plan and they ask you to plan it for the next few years. I don't know. I want to achieve X, Y, Z within the next year. In terms of learning, and then from there on we'll see what happens next. So to me, an adaptive career is something I've instilled in myself from the start. I don't think I'll be in the same industry probably in the next 5-10 years. I'm constantly kind of identifying. So I use pivots. I use them strategically. I also know that I will pivot constantly. But there is science to this madness as I'm going through. And, you know, if you look back through what I've done so far, there's been a learning through every experience that made me want to pivot, but it's always been constructive pivoting. So it's not as if I'm moving into a completely different area where I can't leverage my expertise. So I started actually working at L'Oreal as a process engineer. I was an intern there, and there I loved the fact that I was optimizing processes, but there was no physical product that I was building. So my concept there was like, I've learned process optimization, which is critical into anything you're going to do in the future. And I still use Six Sigma principles to this day, but I wasn't building a product. And then at Rolls-Royce, I said, well, let me actually build an actual product. And I realized, hey, it's great to build a physical product, but life cycles are too long, feedback loops are too slow. Let me move to something with a faster feedback cycle. So I leveraged my expertise in product development, but I moved it to the digital space where I could, you know, iterate on a faster scale. And at Scotiabank, it was learning, you know, moving from waterfall to agile, which we can talk a little bit about later. But I learned that. And I learned that also the banking space was extremely saturated. That it was great because you could relate to the product you were building. There were those fast cycles, as we talked about, but it wasn't exciting enough. I wasn't solving a big problem, at least with a global bank. And so then I moved to PC Financial. And at PC Financial, the aim was to build a new bank. And there we were actually working on family banking, which was a need that was really salient, that was unmet. So to me, it was a problem that I wanted to help solve. And Canadians living paycheck to paycheck. So that was, you know, another move. And then I learned a lot about ecosystems at Loblaws, because Loblaws is a retailer first that was moving into all those different areas. So once I did that, I kind of said, okay, I have faster cycles. I've worked on a big problem, but I need some more motivation right now. I need to see what are all these other problems that are out there. And so working with EP, it's kind of great because we work with 50% of the Fortune 100 companies, and I'm able to see all these problems and learn from all those different challenges while helping them digitize their business, which is my core expertise. So that's where I kind of say there's always adaptive learning in what I do, but it's always complementary into making me a better product leader.
Yeah, and I think the idea of, you know, extrapolating that out to, you know, how does that then operate in society at scale for large workforces, you know, that is, you know, in some ways you'd have L&D, longtime 25-year practitioners of L&D, maybe sort of crying foul as they're listening to this saying, what do you mean you don't set them with a competency model and then just define the next 7 years of their life? Well, it doesn't really work like that today, I think, is the big takeaway, and sort of being agile, being willing to pivot in support of some pull the thread as you sort of progress, so it becomes a sort of additive component of skill upon skill upon skill. And, you know, we talk a lot about it. Does that translate into a capability? Is it more than just knowing it? Can you actually prove it in a work setting? Can you show me examples of work products and assets, whether individual or team or geo or function, that demonstrate you really met that? I have to imagine a little bit some of the organizations that you're consulting with today are grappling with that very same thing. You know, huge pivots for entire parts of the org. What's the next big thing coming across the horizon? any sort of, you know, key themes or words of wisdom to when we think about doing this at scale and extrapolating from your own personal experience there?
Definitely. I think just the first and foremost, understanding that you will pivot. I read a stat recently, 85% of the jobs by 2030 will be net new jobs. It's realizing that you're going to need to pivot as a business. We pivoted even at Experience Point. We were a business that relied purely on workshops. So I wouldn't even have a job at EP, maybe 5 years ago. It's a mindset shift is what I would say first. And you have to acknowledge it and you have to recognize. But I think fundamentally, you also need to align on what it is that you plan to do and achieve as an organization, not specifically around your product and how your product manifests itself, but what mission, like what's your mission, right? What's your mission as an organization? And understanding first and foremost your mission, and then understanding that you will need to pivot. And, you know, we work in horizons, and we recognize that Horizon 3 is unknown to us. While we do have some ideas, we know that within a few horizons, we're going to need to pivot into new territory. As they say, innovate or die.
I'm a big believer in and practitioner of the theories in Pine and Gilmore's The Experience Economy, or discussed in The Experience Economy, one of which is the theory of the progression of economic value. And I see your career journey as a unique articulation of that, from commodities up to goods, services, experiences, and transformation. And now that you're at this inflection point, you know, working for a company called Experience Point, experience has become such a ubiquitous term and concept. We're living in the experience economy. We're optimizing learning experiences for our consumers. We use and create learning experience platforms. And of course, the name of your company is Experience Point. So how do you define experience given your career trajectory and all of your unique experience up to this point? Do you think that there is something to experience no matter the specific context or environment in which that concept is being applied?
Yeah, definitely. Like, I think when you were asking what does experience mean to you? To me, experience is all about a journey. But a journey, as they say, perfection is a continuous journey. So it's that continuous journey for me when you say about experience, and it's that journey that, you know, in some form, you know, in a way where you're headed, at least in terms of direction, but you're very open in terms of where you're going. For customers, I think when we think of a journey, a customer's trying to achieve a goal. And you want to leave them with a memorable journey, a journey where they've achieved that goal. And they may have specific ways they want to achieve that goal, or they may be open on how they want to achieve that goal. And you have to be open and understanding of the fact that they may not know how to get there, especially around learning and development, but they know that they want to achieve something. And you have to be flexible and enabling of that journey. And to me, that's how I think of experience. So when people come to us, they want to become better innovators. They may not know how to become better innovators. They may not know what it means to become a better innovator. All they know is they need to change. And it can be as ambiguous as that when they come to us. There's a need for change in our business. We don't know how we're going to achieve it. We don't know what it means to change. And I think our job in that case is kind of enlightening them into what is a potential path you can take without being too prescriptive. So that's how I think of customer experience. Right now I think employee experience, which is the other side, I've been a big advocate of it. I think companies are not doing enough when it comes to employee experience. They still think of it as very linear. And they wonder why we have a great resignation. To me, it's pretty straightforward. I haven't seen one company that is thinking about how to make it a better experience for their employees. All they think about is, are they coming back to the office? Do we have a hybrid workforce? But instead, I haven't seen anybody ask, how can we create the best experience possible for our employees so that they either want to be together, or they want to come to work, or they want to do things differently or think differently?
Where do you see that? Is that more of a lack of acknowledgement, or just I have no idea where to start? Like, I understand onboarding, of course, I have to get them, and that's 90 days, and then I forget about it. Off they should go and be productive employee workforce for me. Where do you think the miss there? Is it an L&D HR talent ownership piece? Is it the business? Is it worlds coming together and saying we must, you know, sort of support these folks in all moments of their progressive journey along the way, not just the, you know, kind of the onboarding and offboarding components? What's your take on that?
I think it's a mix. It starts first, I think, with obviously accountability. There's an assumption that it has to sit with HR and L&D. But in reality, it's evolving, and everybody should own employee experience, from leaders of divisions, leaders of groups, to down to HR. And so I think, you know, first and foremost, it's a shared responsibility and acknowledgement that it is one. But you do need to have this on kind of like someone's radar to own it. Right. So I think there's the accountability portion. There's another one, which I read a very interesting book, Employee Experience by Design. And it talks about like the different components of employee experience. And it starts with, what we call hygiene employee experience. So those are the basics. And sometimes people assume hygiene employee experience as being like the end goal. So hygiene employee experience are things like pay on time, perks, things like that. So people start to take these for granted, but they need to be there in the basis. And sometimes people assume that this is kind of like the end state. Then there's what you call, which is what you've talked about a little bit, Todd, which was life cycle employee experience. So those are, onboarding, critical moments in that journey. And an example of life cycle employee experience that's purely missed is departures. We treat I was treated a few departures like an outsider as soon as I announced my departure. And I'm surprised that companies do that, because I am a big believer in boomerang employees. And again, in that adaptive economy and adaptive career path, who knows, you might come back with a company with a different set of experiences and a different role. And so we treat, for example, departure, when I say we, majority of companies treat departures very differently. And so that's an example of life cycle employee experience. There's also then, everyday employee experience. So that's what your leader would exhibit. Those are the norms that you would create within your groups. And so those are the changes you can do individually as leaders. That is also often missed, or is the only component sometimes, and it's not enough to actually propagate employee experience. So those are just some examples of, how I see employee experience and how I think in some instances it's being missed.
Yeah, it's interesting, especially that that idea of the departure offboarding, and I it's going to hit other industries exceedingly hard. And I spent a lot of time earlier in my career on the consultancy side, working in utility organizations, large scale public utilities or private utilities, and the idea of you've had folks that are tenured for 25, 30 years sometimes, and they exit the workforce, and there's this massive missed opportunity, whether they boomerang back or not, or some sort of reverse mentoring or not reverse. Standard mentoring practice, ability to kind of contribute back to the corporate memory of the organization. Instead, they're sort of just pushed aside, even this exit, and the amount of tacit knowledge and understanding that lives and breathes inside them, that we should be doing a far better job of providers, practitioners, consultancies, of helping these client organizations capture that, because I think once gone, it is exceedingly difficult, if not impossible, to get it back. And I don't know if you're seeing that at Experience Point with a lot of the sort of that tied in with the Great Resignation or aging workforces and I think what do we have, six generations in the workforce at this point. Let's take advantage of those folks that are have learned and experienced so much.
Absolutely, and I think are we seeing it? I think everybody's seeing it. We probably maybe are seeing it on a lower scale than other businesses. But what's really interesting to me in the last few companies I've seen is, these during the pandemic, and who I speak to, you speak to individuals and they say I'm leaving, but they're not leaving anywhere. And to me, that's extremely interesting for you to have made a decision to leave, to go nowhere. It means you've lost hope in the company, and I hope many companies start to see this as a signal of what are we not doing right and what should we start doing. I keep saying I'm super surprised that companies are still wondering what should we be doing, and they don't listen to their employees. They're not asking the questions. They're not building those memorable experiences. They do it for customers, but they're not doing it for their employees. And you have to recognize that employees are customers of the workforce, right? And you have to treat them in the same way, because they're as critical to your business in creating value. The client may be capturing value, but there's no value to be captured if you can't deliver it, right? And so remember the root of your business.
And I mean, we think a lot of that has to do with opportunities for collaboration and experimentation and building new programs. We have Jonathan Kapolsky, who's former CMO of Deloitte, coming to speak at our book club live event in a few weeks, and he co-wrote a book called The Transformation Myth. And part of their research for that book showed that digitally mature companies are more likely to have culture characterized by these attributes, experimentation, collaboration, cross-functional teaming. You're in the business of creating or cultivating cultures of innovation for your clients in service of great experience, employee, customer, otherwise. Can you talk a little bit about culture's relationship to transformation and innovation over the course of your career and how you help clients now?
Absolutely. So I'll start maybe with my experience at PC, because PC was a business where it wasn't, I wouldn't say it was digitally mature at the onset, right? And I'll answer your question, I promise, Alex, around, you know, what does culture mean to overall a digital transformation, at least from my perspective. But at PC, we, as you know, we were partnered with CIBC. CIBC ran all the digital properties. And then I was hired, and a few of us were hired to kind of build PC's new bank. And that was a big transformation, because now PC was going to own its own digital experience, was going to own the customer experience. So the first thing we did kind of with PC was the mechanics of a transformation, which is, let's put together a cross-functional team. Let's put together the mechanics to deliver in an agile way. Let's then, you know, obviously design and deliver the experience. But so that was the basic component, what I would say, like infrastructure in a transformation that you need to set up, a well-oiled machine, as they say. But the culture component is what makes it stick for the future, because if you don't have a culture, a mature culture or a culture of innovation, for example, what's going to end up happening is you're going to end up with the right infrastructure, but you're going to have challenges feeding into that structure, and you're going to have challenges outputting as well. So an example of a change in mindset and culture in the case of PC that would have been needed is, okay, how do we then plan going forward? How do we triage new innovation ideas? When do we experiment, and when do we scale those experiments? And then how do we even budget for new innovation in the future, right? Without those aspects and that mindset, which is why we talk a lot at EP about there's the skills component. So have we hired teams that are capable of delivering in a digital world, right? Cross-functional teams. Have we then established the infrastructure to enable those teams? So agile delivery, for example. But last but not least, which gets forgotten, is like, have we established different mindsets? Have we established the right conditions for these teams to flourish, right? And operate? And oftentimes the answer is going to be no. And that's actually a big reason why people leave, including talent leaves, in my opinion, because they have the infrastructure, they're talented, they were brought in to bring in change. They can't actually instill change because the conditions are not conducive. And the conditions can be everything from sponsorship, to processes around, you know, triaging, to budgeting. So it's everything from down, you know, to mindset, down to even mindset and leadership mindset when you think about culture. So that's why I think at EP, we focus a lot on both skills and conditions. We teach you the basics of design thinking to innovate. We teach you what is necessary to have a creative workforce, but we also illuminate the critical components of establishing a culture of innovation. And we do have proprietary ways of doing so with companies that want to scale with us, where we, you know, work with a core team, and then we establish teams of catalysts that can then bring in and sustain change in the longer term. Big proponent of culture. And I would say without culture, you're not going to have change that sticks.
Yeah, it's interesting, Ramses, I hear you talk about that, you know, a couple of themes around sort of the behaviors, the repetition, the organizational behaviors that have to cascade up from individuals, the reinforcing components. I think that becomes a big one in your world, hence the catalyst, the teams that then, you know, basically work outward and broadly across the org. And then this idea of mentors and managers, right? How can we continue to reinforce that with individuals over time, not just individual practice or processes, but people, humans? You know, calling to light and bringing that forward and reminding people that, yeah, this is who we want to be into the future. And I mean, how important do you see that idea of sort of the reinforcing the mentor coach construct, you know, sort of allowing people to continue in these innovative practices in the organizations you consult?
Yeah, very important, Todd. And I would say that I would encourage you guys, if you haven't, on our website, we have a chat bot, and we built something we call a skills and conditions assessment tool within that bot. So obviously go take a look at it after. I'm not trying to show off our product, but what it does is it basically takes skills and conditions that we've mapped, and you know, it tells you where you are based on some basic answers that you'll you know, questions that you'll answer. And it's been proven because that's a methodology we've used through a lot of engagements. And it tells you where you are in that spectrum. So kind of, do you have the skill set in your organizations, but not the right conditions? And if so, what should you be doing? Or do you have the right conditions in your organization, but not the right skill set? And also what you should be doing. Ideally, that latter is the easier one. If you have the conditions, but not the skill sets can be acquired. But the other way is much more difficult to scale.
For certain, without question, which Ramsey, makes me think a little bit about, you know, there are a couple other core tenets that we hold near and dear in our clientele, you know, in terms of at NovaWeb, things about being collaborative, about being contextual, about being safe. And we talk a lot about risk-taking and experimentation in service of innovation. Would love to hear you talk a little bit about, you know, safety's role in enabling, you know, innovative workplace culture and how do you create that optimal safe environment or context, conditions, you know, for innovation to thrive in person now and perhaps even more importantly, virtually or in this hybrid world that seem to continue forward for us in perpetuity.
Awesome. And yeah, and Todd, I think there are two answers there that I'll give you, because there's about experimentation in general. I think there's an aspect around experimentation. I'll talk about my experience there of how I helped instill that culture, at least at EP internally, because we were very good at doing it with clients, but we had to drink our own champagne as well internally, right? So I can talk about that journey. And then I could talk about more specifically, you know, what are conditions that are needed for experimentation to flourish as a whole? And we can drill deeper there. So with experimentation in of itself, I'll share an example of adaptive learning. So I realized that we needed to get experimentation going more aggressively at EP, but I also realized that I had experimented only by doing, and I had never actually learned the basics of experimentation. So I did go back and get upskilled on experimentation last year. And took a course at Section 4. It was fantastic, by the way. It was a sprint on experimentation. And it talked about, you know, three aspects of experimentation, which are understanding the risks first of the product that you're building, and then building a culture of experimentation around that. So that's specific around product development. But then I'll take it broader in an organization. So within the context of a product, for example, it talked about, and we were, you know, doing it. It's like the three pieces of risk in a product is a demand risk, supply risk, and then value risk, right? And so with every instance, how do you understand where the risk exists? And then how do you design experiments to de-risk each potential risk? So that's very specific to product development, right? And you may say, okay, now I have a framework, how do I do so? Well, now that you've understood the framework, it's easy to say, I'm gonna design experiments. But the challenge you're gonna run into is if you don't have sponsorship, they're quickly gonna say, where are the results, right? And you're gonna turn back into, okay, we're not experimenting anymore. We're quickly trying to solve a problem. So that's where I say conditions are super important. So sponsorship. Two, you need teams to be able to experiment, right? So you need an infrastructure. Who experiments? Does everybody experiment? And that's fair if you do it. Does marketing start experimenting? Does product start experimenting? In my experience, it's been start with experimentation within a group, start to showcase that behavior, and then scale it to other groups, because then you'll get way more traction when it comes to experimentation. So I took on experimentation on the product team, and then slowly now I'm taking it out into marketing and to different functions, because now people start to realize, okay, it's a mindset. You know what? We can see quick results. One example of experimentation that we ran was pricing on our website. Should we show pricing or not for learning and development, right? And everybody was like, do we lose sales or do we? And so I said, well, why don't we experiment, right? And so it's that default mindset of let's experiment. And then it's who's going to experiment? Well, we have the infrastructure that the product team will experiment. And here's how we're going to design it. Third is leadership buy-in. So it's one thing to have sponsors, but if people are not going to buy into your results, they're going to say, was this sample representative enough? You know, there's always someone that's going to try to find something to break the experiment. But I think if you have leadership buy-in, that experimentation is going to give us a direction. Then that's going to be a win. Four, you're going to need budget to experiment. Oftentimes, you're not given budget to experiment. It takes a budget to experiment. So as again, back to the conditions that you need, budget is an example of something that is often forgotten. Yeah, let's experiment. Well, I don't have budget to experiment. We have to be willing to. And so I'm a big believer in releasing funds as you experiment versus allocating an entire fund to a product, right? So that. And then the last one is community. Like, do we have a community where we can share best practices when we're experimenting? So that's another example of an element of conditions that Alex was talking about. So people tend to forget to put these conditions in place. So it's one thing to teach you how to experiment, but if I haven't put these five things, for example, that I just spoke about, you're going to very quickly get either a frustrated employee that's not going to be able to experiment, or you're going to get experiments that make it nowhere.
Reg, talk to us about, because the idea of community, we're seeing that becoming ever more important across, you know, the clients that we're working with, and more explicitly in both sort of business realm and also in the learning and development space. It's not enough that I just, in pursuit of personalized learning at scale, or that I individually sort of upskill or reskill or even a small team, but I need to be able to bring that back into my context of my work setting and then constantly share and iterate across the organization. Is, you know, talk to us a little bit about, because you mentioned teams as a core condition or component, and you mentioned community. Is that in lip service, or do you feel like those are just instrumental to being able to kind of move organizations forward in this day and age? What's your take on that?
They're definitely instrumental. I think, like, when you think of an organization like Loblaws, I would say the community is more internal, right? Design communities internally, because we're seeing different things. Loblaws was an ecosystem, right? It's operating in so many different industries, from they have Shoppers Drug Mart, so pharma, we had the bank, we had travel, we had insurance, we had you name it, healthcare, like everything. We had groceries, which is the main business. So there, an internal community was critical, because it was bound that once one group had tried something. And so if we could start sharing the learnings between each other, one, obviously there's a bit of shift in context, but someone had tried something and learned from it, right? Conversions, whether it's checkout for retail or you're checking out on a travel website, there's a lot of learnings to be shared in between them in how you design, right? Launch, you know, scaling agility in your organization. Again, there may be different nuances, but everybody had learned about the pains of scaling agile in their own group or organizations. So for big companies, I recommend communities be internal, but for smaller companies, I recommend communities be external. And so it's like looking at communities of practice within your area of expertise, but it can give you very nuanced, like a wide variance and nuance of different industries that have seen it in different scales. So that's why I'm a big believer in communities. I participate in communities where I find that there is not enough of an internal community, or we don't have the size and diversity. So I definitely recommend, if you're a big company, focus on a community, an internal community at least, to share, especially if you're very siloed and you have divisions. And if you're a smaller company, try to find adjacent communities of practice, because ultimately it's a big component of sustaining learning.
No, I absolutely, and I think you're us, you know, talking and publishing, writing a lot about this academy construct, whether it's a corporate academy or a capability academy, but, you know, that's not a name only. That's because this idea of a place, of an opportunity to return for growth, for development, for reflection, for, cross organization dialogue and deployment is important. And the only way you can do that is by creating that sense of community. So I love that idea of what you're talking about, how that can apply to mid-market or SMB, where if your community is a community of 40, maybe that doesn't feel so great, but all of a sudden now sort of, you know, put those arms out broader for other organizations.
Yeah, and a common misconception, again, Todd, because we're looking at community as well. We have facilitators that we train, but we also have, like, our participants, right? And so you wonder, where does the community, where is the community need there? But an often misconception with community is you have to build your own place. And what I would encourage anybody considering community, at least this is what I'm learning, experimenting, is observe first your audience, because your audience might already be in a place, and either decide if you inject yourself in that place or if you truly want to build your own community. And if you are, then what is that value add that you're offering? Because we often rush into the concept of community without understanding the implications of it. So again, another just nudge for anybody considering a community: understand, like, before you jump in, it doesn't always have to be a place that you own. You might want to join an existing place.
So ultimately, it's all about facilitating connection between people and networking and connecting dots. And in the spirit of that idea, and now knowing that you come from a family of poets and artists and musicians, Ramsey, can you share a little bit about why dot connecting and interdisciplinarity are critical capabilities in business today, and maybe how some of your interdisciplinary upbringing, art, and science have bearing on the way that you think around business now?
Absolutely. I think just to even start, you know, Rabbani as a family name, as you mentioned, Alex, you know, if you Google it on Wikipedia, is has a long history of musicians and artists. I can't sing even in the shower. So I think one of the aspects, though, I think I got was creative thinking. And so connecting the dots there, while I wasn't talented on that front, having built and connected the dots, I find I'm way more creative now. I'm able to, because I've seen different, I've seen it in, I've continued to build that nonlinear career path. I'm able to connect the dots way faster because it's a mindset that I've established. So learning and development space, I knew nothing about it 10 months ago. Right? I knew how to build digital products. I knew how to build digital platforms, but I didn't understand the learning and development space enough. So when I joined the company, I focused a lot on what is that typical L&D journey when building a capability. But the mindset I've helped establish is that, you know, there is a cycle when you're building a capability, and let's digitize this business first. This is where I can help. This is where my strengths can help. And then I'll learn about the L&D space as we go along, but helping shift the mindset, helping shift to those kind of were the critical components for me. And so I'm able to problem solve way faster nowadays because of that adaptive career path I've taken. And I also know my strengths and my weaknesses. I know where I can leverage my strength, and I know where I just need to listen and learn. And so I think this is kind of, this is how it's helped me significantly in my career.
Ramsey, it's I would be remiss if we didn't ask you a final question as you sort of look back across, you know, your progression, you know, professionally, personally. Can you talk a little bit about maybe a couple of the marquee influences in your life, be they inspiring mentors, colleagues, facilitators, folks that you have spent time with that have helped you sort of progress and move to where you are today?
Yeah, definitely. I think, Todd, I'll start with, it's going to sound cliche, but my parents, but for a simple reason is that, you know, when I went to law school for 2 weeks and I said I was leaving, I remember my mom saying, you know what you're doing, Ramsey, if you're doing it for a reason, I know, you know, you must be doing it for a reason. So go ahead. And I pivoted a lot in my career. And the answer I've gotten from my parents is, you know what you're doing. Always trust your gut feel. And so I have to say that it starts with that. It starts with someone that enabled me versus, no, you must stay in this. Or what are you doing? Are you out of your mind? And so now it's built my confidence significantly because every time it's that answer that I have in the back of my mind that says, trust your gut. You've trusted it to this state and it's paid well. So keep moving in that direction. So my parents, absolutely. And there is a resiliency that my parents have shown because they've grown in their career significantly. And my mom was purely showing me examples of pivoting as she went along. So my mom had 4 kids she started with the same job as my dad. And she unfortunately couldn't keep that job because it was just too taxing with 4 kids. But my mother wanted to still be leveraging her skill set. So she had a minor in education and she ended up becoming a school teacher because she could go with the kids and drop them off and come back with the kids. And she ended up moving up to a principal after. And, you know, it ended up, you know, being a career that she was passionate, superbly passionate. But that's an example of someone that's adaptive too, right? So showcasing that adaptive behavior. So parents, I was also very lucky. Every job I've gotten, I always say it, you know, I won't use the word boss, but a leader. I've always had leaders that have been selfless and have coached me. So every single job I've taken, my leader has been beyond amazing. They've shown me selflessness. They've shown me traits about leaders that I admire a lot. My last leader, I remember, said to me, I'm not here to tell you about digital. You're the expert. I'm here to coach you and guide you so you can be a better version of yourself as a leader. So imagine when someone comes in and tells you that at the onset, it's called selflessness, but also confidence and self-awareness. And so every single, I use every single job as a learning opportunity, everything from the job itself to the leaders, to the people. And there are also people that have marked me that are really not good. And I remember being, I don't want to be those people. So I use everything as a learning opportunity. And my advice to anybody would be have an open mindset. You know, you may have downfalls, but remember it's going to be learning opportunities in the grand scheme of things. Take everything as a learning opportunity, soak it in. and be comfortable with pivoting. And if you aren't, try a different job.
NovoEd empowers organizations to build deep capabilities rather than mere skills through cohort-based learning that drives true readiness to perform on the job. For more episodes of the Wildly Capable podcast, or for more information on NovoEd, please visit us at NovoEd.com.